presentation is the first of two related papers that Tony and I are presenting at this conference. And this first one is about the ethical challenges that educational researchers face when researching in social media spaces. So, Tony will tell you a little bit more about the research that has got us to this place.
Okay, so our exploration of ethics is grounded in two Facebook-based research studies that we've done. A little bit of background is that we're pretty involved in public engagement, academics engaging with the wider society outside of the a campus. So that's kind of our area. And we've been working with using open educational resources with public communities. So giving people stuff that's relevant to their interests. The first study we did was in 2013, where we worked with some groups, basically for parents of children with autism. And they were in India, Kenya, Malaysia, Nigeria. I think it was a South African one as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So that was the first one. And they involved about 5,000 people, members of the groups, so it was a fairly large study. And the second group was just in the last year, where we've been looking at Open University students. So these are study-related student-led groups. So these are groups that Open University students have set up themselves in connection with their studying. And you'll see that we have reported on 10 groups, 2,500 members, and 4 different disciplines. So we looked across the curriculum areas. And the key question was, are these groups educational? Are they facilitating learning? And what goes on in the groups?
So we can locate our research on something of a continuum, and I've represented that across the top. So on the left is conventional research that is bound by ethical guidelines such as those by the British Educational Research Association, the American Educational Research Association. The other end of the continuum is guerrilla research, which is a do-it-yourself and do-it-now approach. That relies on existing data, it relies on existing information and tools, and something that requires no permission. And we're sort of in the middle, in the open research section. Being from the Open University, we've got a strong culture of open research now. But that actually requires negotiating both ends of this continuum, as this discussion will show. And it involves negotiating a number of sets of ethical guidelines. I've mentioned BERA, the British Association, and ERA, the American Association. So we were working with those guidelines, but also guidelines written specifically for use in social media spaces. Now, one person who does write about ethics in social media spaces, Zimmer, says that concerns over consent, privacy, and anonymity do not disappear simply because subjects participate in online social networks. Rather, they become ever more important. It's our responsibility as scholars to ensure our research methods and process remain rooted in long-standing ethical practices. So that's the basis of the work that we're doing.
Okay, so we're dividing up the remainder of this session into before, during, and after the research. And the first bit, first ethical challenges occur before you go anywhere near the spaces. So core to traditional ethic guidelines is the requirement to gain informed consent. And that's closely related to the distinction between private and public spaces. First piece of research we did in the autism groups, there were a mixture of public and closed groups. For those of you who aren't familiar with Facebook, there are three statuses of groups. There are public groups, which until recently were called open groups. Then there are closed groups, and then there are secret groups. Secret groups you can't discover. You have to be in them to know that they exist. You can't search for them, they're not indexed. Public groups, on the other hand, are eminently discoverable, and everybody can see what goes on in them. The closed groups are somewhere in the middle, so they're relatively easy to join. But the content is closed just to the members of the group. In the autism study, we negotiated informed consent with the moderators of each of the groups. So we actually wrote to the moderators, told them what we were up to, and negotiated consent to do our research with them. But for the most recent OU study, we only examined public groups. So this means that all the stuff that's going on in those groups was viewable to any of the 1.5 billion people with a Facebook account. So we believe that constitutes a public space, much like going into a public park. And much as in a park, you don't need to negotiate consent to watch what happens there. We think that the same approach applies to a public Facebook group. In fact, the ERA guidelines say, I'll have to read this bit out, education researchers may conduct research in public places or use publicly available information about individuals, for example, naturalistic observation in public places, analysis of public records, or archival research without obtaining consent. So that's the one that we've gone with for this, for the second bit of research. And another factor is that if we'd tried to get informed consent, we'd never have been able to do the research, given the scale that we're working on.
So I'm going to talk about the second aspect of ethical considerations before the actual research takes place. And this is to do with when you're researching in connection with your own institution. So we were researching OU students who were in student-led groups, but still we would be able to, in theory, triangulate information with records that we have on our own management information systems. And at this stage, it's really, really important to find out what your institution's policy is or what the employment regulations are regarding what and when to disclose if you find evidence of bad practice. So it could be, you know, poor academic practice, plagiarism, bullying, things like that. You know, what, as an employee of a particular institution, what are your obligations? Now, this is tied up with the risk to the participants. Even if they're passive participants, you're just observing in a public space. There's a risk involved, and it's your responsibility as the researcher. And one particular reason why this is more important than when if you're researching in a public park, that Tony mentioned, is because of the phenomenon of online disinhibition. And you may have come across research on this sort of over the past few years, but essentially, it's the fact that people behave differently online, shed some of their inhibitions for a number of different reasons. Firstly, this idea that they're anonymous dissociates them from their all proper lifestyle identities. They feel as they're a different person behaving in a different way, and they're less accountable. And that that's linked with invisibility. So the fact that you can sort of get away with anything, really, and it doesn't matter. The asynchronicity of Facebook and Twitter, with the exception of Facebook chats, means that people don't get an immediate, say, feedback on the things that they do. Things happen a bit later. So reactions to things you do happen a bit later. So people that feel more free to post things and say things that they wouldn't in real time to real people. This whole business of solipsistic introjection and dissociative imagination.
Great word.
I've got through it even though I've got a cold. So that is imagining the people that you're communicating with as particular personalities that exist in your head. And so not as real people, but just you're imagining that they're fictional characters. And then essentially, if they're fictional characters, you haven't got as much responsibility to them. And so you say, well, it's not real. They're not real people out there. They're just fictional people. And that, again, leads to people shedding inhibitions. And finally, if especially in the student-led spaces, if there's no obvious figure of authority there, people get away with, feel they can share what they like. Here, a couple of things here. You can't read that, but that's somebody criticising their boss, and the response says, here's your B45, essentially. And there's a real Facebook post. And that's something being sick. So, we'll come back to online disinhibition later, but move on to what happens during the research. And Tony will say a bit more about that.
Okay. So, one of the key questions to ask is whether you join the groups or not. Do you just observe from the outside, or do you actually go in there and join them? And if you do join, do you disclose that you're doing research or not? And you have choices about all these things. So, with the autism groups, we did discuss these things. We put, as I said, we negotiated consent with the moderators of the groups. The moderators treated it differently. Some of them put a post up and asked the group what they thought about it. In general, they were really positive. It's a really healthy and a fruitful relationship all around. Others, interestingly, felt that they owned the group and that they felt they were able to give consent on behalf of the rest of the group. It's an interesting dynamic.
It's interesting to mention that the part of this research we were doing with the autism groups was joining the groups. That was part of the whole process. We were sharing resources. We were discussing things, so the people in the groups were familiar with them, and it was quite a sort of an active process.
Yeah. But for the use of the most recent one, we only studied public groups, and we didn't need to engage with the group members in order to do it. So we didn't need to join the groups the second time around. And so we didn't join the groups, didn't declare our status. And that's closely related to the public-private distinction, that all this stuff there is out in the public domain. 1.5 billion people can see it, and they can all record it and analyse it. Anyone can do it. One of the factors to bear in mind, if you're going through this kind of process, is the consequences of joining the groups. As I said, these groups, particularly the parents of children with autism groups, are generally very flat hierarchical groups. So it's parents helping other parents, sharing what they know. And if there's a researcher from a reputable academic institution who's got a background in childhood stuff, if you join the group, you become a different sort of person in that group. There is a power imbalance. And you kind of have to think that kind of stuff through a bit. Think about, watch the group, look at how it operates, and think about what impact your joining may have.
And that's sort of closely linked to the idea that if you do step in and your people know about your presence, the research, the activities you're observing will be different by virtue of your presence. So that authenticity gets lost. And this has been, these sort of decisions have been made for a number of years now, since people were researching in online forums. The same decisions had to be made.
The other thing that happens during the research is obviously you get confronted by a huge amount of personal data. So we were looking at 2,500 students for just £1 a month. You won't believe how much data was gobbled up in that process. So every time you look at the group, and I was looking at these groups for hours on end, you see loads and loads of personal information. It's really easy to identify people. You keep seeing the same people again and again. You get a feel for them, their interests. You're working with masses and masses of personal, private data that they've chosen to share. And they're not just random members of the public. When we're looking at OU student groups, these are our students who I'm likely to have contact with in other relationships. So capturing it all is really important, because, as you know, Facebook is a very transitory and fluid medium. We talked about the status of the groups earlier, and that there are public, closed, and secret groups. And it's quite common for student groups to begin as public for the first couple of weeks of the term, as it were. Once all students have joined, they then become closed. And it's then quite common, if they have hassle, to become secret. So it's not a fixed thing you're working with. And if you start working with an open group and you want to capture that stuff, you've got to get it quick, because if the status changes, you then can't use it. So it's a fluid, it's a transitory medium. You've got to capture the stuff somehow, but it contains all this private information. And that is a nightmare, frankly. You see, you've got all this personal stuff, and you've got to think about really carefully about how you're going to protect that data when you're doing it. Facebook doesn't make it easy for you. They encourage people to share data that we wouldn't ordinarily share, and you can't strip out that stuff when you're collecting the data. It all comes in.
So, moving on now to third phase of the research. What happens after the research when you're reporting and disseminating the research findings? And at this stage, there's three sort of areas to think about. It's protecting the individual participants, protecting the online community, and Tony has touched upon that already, and also the whole business of image ethics. Now, in terms of anonymising research, I mentioned earlier the British Educational Research Association and the American Educational Research Association are sort of go-to places for guidelines for the researcher. However, on the matter of anonymising research, especially research from public places, they differ. So BERA, the British guidelines, take a very cautious view that everything should be anonymised. However, their guidelines don't actually discuss social media spaces. ERA, the American research guidelines, they take a more liberal position, and they state, and I'll read this out, confidentiality is not required with respect to observations in public places, activities conducted in public, or other settings where no rules of privacy are provided by law or custom. So they're much more liberal. Now, on this occasion, I mentioned that Tony earlier said that we were closer to ERA on another matter. Here, we took a position closer to BERA, because we felt that as a responsible researcher, it's very, very much about the context of your research and the content of the things that you are reporting on. And going back to the whole business of online disinhibition, people are sharing more than they necessarily would, so their filters are down more than people would be in a face-to-face situation. And so we took the decision to anonymise absolutely everything. And because Facebook is a very, very visual medium, as if you use Facebook you'll know, this meant also anonymising all the avatars by blurring them out, blurring out the names, anything that could identify people. And again, this also goes back to what Tony was saying about people within the institution being able to triangulate the research. Triangulation usually a good thing, but if it means identifying people from university records, that's not a good thing. So it's protecting your participants. And we've protected the group names as well. We typically, when we write papers, we encourage people to contact us if they want to verify the veracity of the research. But one reason for protecting the community is, again, to do with the delicate nature of the way communities behave. Jane mentioned about the hierarchies. The relationships can be very, very fragile. And if you bring a community under a microscope and they see a report about how the behaviour is taking place and the relationships between people, it could disrupt a community that's really functioning very well. So again, it's being responsible as a researcher and to take responsibility for your own actions. Now, an interesting little conundrum emerges in that Facebook actually says that you shouldn't adulterate any screenshots that you do from Facebook. So you shouldn't blur anything or change anything on there. You can't annotate it, but we think that, yeah. We think there are responsibilities to the people.
They haven't stopped us yet.
They haven't stopped us yet, and I don't suspect our research isn't even on their radar, actually. So, and there is another school of thought within research on Facebook that says that all of the images are valuable evidence, and the way that people present themselves in their avatars are valuable evidence. And so there's a school of thought that says that in itself is a layer of rich data that is lost. True. And in a different setting, maybe we could use that sort of data, but it's not essential to our study. And so that's why we anonymize it. So they're really the three stages: before, during, and after. I think you'll have picked up by now, it's a murky business. It very much depends on the researcher really closely engaging with the content that is being researched and thinking through this quite new space. The traditional ethics guidelines, as Eric said this morning, we haven't got there in our use of social media yet. We may have got there a bit with email, but this is still pioneering territory in some ways. And I think in terms of the moral compass that we use in which to research in these spaces, there's a lot more discussion is needed. People need to be comparing their own experiences to find out what's the right thing to do as a responsible researcher. So we don't have any answers, we just have experiences, I think, and our own story of doing it.